So welcome, everybody, to today's teleconference. I'll first start by asking if there are any announcements.
I can...
Go ahead.
Well, this is Kristen Poppleton at the Will Steger Foundation. I just wanted to... I thought it was a timely announcement. We're just ramping up for our Summer Institute for Teachers on Climate Change in August, and have confirmed that Jeannie Scott will be coming to speak from NCSE on the evening before for a public forum co-sponsored with the Humphrey Institute for Public Policy. So if you are in the Midwest and are interested, that will be August 6th. And our Teacher Institute runs the 7th through 8th, and our keynote opening speaker will be John Abraham from the Climate Rapid Response Team. So just a few things coming, falling into line right now.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks. Any other announcements?
This is Frank Niepold over at NOAA. Some of you may have seen the 10 Signs of a Warming World poster released at NSTA. We're putting the final touches on the supporting website at climate.noaa.gov/warmingworld, all one word.
Yeah.
I haven't sent out an announcement to the listserv just because we still have a couple things more, but we're centrally highlighting clean resources that relate to the climate indicators that we do in the State of the Climate Report from NOAA and the other organizations that put that out. So that should
great.
This is Caroline. We had the CLIO Institute. We had two excellent interactions with scientists. One at the Florida Atlantic University held a hydrology of the Everglades in the Changing Climate Summit with Army Corps of Engineers and South Florida Water Management District and the Den of Thieves, very good scientists, very earnest, a very male crowd. And they had me open on climate change engagement on, you know, the CLIO project and what we're doing. And they embraced the discussion so robustly that they started adding public engagement strategies in their PowerPoints that very day. And the feedback I got is that the scientists almost needed to be appreciated for the efforts they were making and encouraged to do more. So I share that story with you all. And I also had the opportunity to attend that White House Summit on Women and the Environment at the end of March, and met Lisa Jackson and a few people from the EPA, and was just so impressed with her first priority for the EPA is action on climate change. And the conversation was a lot more hopeful than the information that trickles down to me. And pretty much the message from all of us was, can you tell your story a little bit more loudly? Can we do like a national public service announcement campaign so that everybody sees themselves in the discussion, from military to school children and bankers and corporate people? And so it was a promising experience and energizing in a lot of ways. And we had a little thing about mental health the other day, and it's true. I mean, you get bogged down in some of the negative and stop to sort of celebrate some of the good things and momentum. And so I leave with a question. I had a meeting of my advisory team yesterday at the CLIO Institute, and we want to pretty much declare that the tide is turning in public opinion on climate change. And I know that different studies talk about, you know, the attitudinal response and the beliefs. But I think by and large, if you track the trend, would you all agree with that statement? Are we getting a momentum towards civic engagement and a political will? Is there an informal sense and any formal documentation from any of you?
This is Frank. The one outstanding issue that the researchers who do this work is there is a bit of a disparity between, say, what the Six Americas research finds and Gallup and others and Pew, and what John Krosnick finds out of Stanford. So it's hard to tell. The interoperability between these, actually, John Krosnick just has a paper about this. I don't have my hands on it, but it's an interesting question, Carolyn. I don't know. I don't know if the data analysis is really there, but perhaps.
Well, thank you. Anyone else?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is Mark, and I think Josh and I can talk a little bit about this in some of the work that we're doing here at the National Center for Science Education.
I was going to say, Mark and Josh's talk as far as seems to be right along addressing those lines.
Yeah, but you know, nothing is stopping me from saying, in my gut, I feel a tide moving. I'm not saying I scientifically know this, so I can talk at the emotional point of view, but if there's ever some data backing the trend, if not the exact message, you know, I'd really appreciate that.
Okay, good. Are there any other announcements?
Yeah, this is Gary Brosh. Hello, everybody. I have a couple things. I wanted to remind everybody that the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences is opening their big new science research wing on Earth Day weekend. And I don't know if any of you, if you've seen it, I can send an image of it along later to the network, but it looks like the planet has rolled up against a building in right across from the legislation building in Raleigh is what this building looks like. It's a 50, they made a 50-foot Earth, and inside is a 40-foot projection screen, a circular screen. Batwood and Robin is a very highly esteemed museum, interactive production house, did specialized programs for that about climate change and environmental change, heavily focused on climate change. And I think they'll, in terms of places to show your work and places to connect up with to get an audience for educational ideas and entertainment in the science realm, they're going to be a center for that, I think. And that's the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences on their website. Second of all, the climate change application for the iPad that I took part in, opening with time. Climate change is out there going well. I urge you to check it out or have your 17-year-old offspring check it out.
Is that what it's called, climate change?
It's called
What's the exact name of it?
Painting with Time, Climate Change. The Painting with Time logo comes from this company that I work with that already has one that explores the changes over time, like tides coming in and people getting older and plants growing and things like that. But he's very committed to climate education. And so what I wanted to say really is that in the advance is, number one, we're probably going to be looking for someone to work with to help turn this idea, this app, into a more useful tool for education. Second of all, he is working very hard, and I think we'll release within the next couple weeks a version of this app for the iPhone, which will open it up to millions more people that don't have the iPad. And the interactive part of this is that you choose a picture to change, like Mount Hood or Lake Powell or the tundra or coastline, and the old picture, and you wipe your finger across the old picture, and the new picture appears, and it's like you're making the change yourself with your finger. Very interactive.
Did you say what it's called again? Because I'm actually searching for it right now, and I can't find it. What's it called
again? If you're looking on, I don't know if it's on what Google shows up, but it's in the Apple App Store.
Well, that's where I am.
Painting with Time.
Changing with Time?
Painting. Painting, yes. Like Sherman Williams.
Okay, well, maybe you can send it out to the email list. That might be the most effective way.
I will do that. I will do that.
Okay,
for
great.
Sure. And then the other thing I wanted to just remind everybody, I don't want to be tooting my own too much, but I want to remind everybody that the book that I did with Lynn Cherry, All We Know What We Know About a Changing Climate, is still the perfect book for a lot of education that people are talking about in terms of showing how science works and what scientists are doing and how kids can learn from scientists and how kids and teachers can do the same kind of work in their schoolyard to learn about climate. So I feel it should be listed on more websites in terms of resources. Just a little reminder, thank you all very much, and thanks again for all your continued information. I learned so much from all the feeds that come from the network. Thanks a lot.
Okay, I just have this is Tamara. I have a couple of quick announcements. First of all, we are putting together a set of 7 AGU climate literacy session proposals that will be going in by the end of next week. And then I also want to remind people that April 25th is the deadline for the NAAEE sessions, and those are for actual presentations as opposed to sessions where you'll be putting together a group of speakers. And so that's due later this week. So are there any other announcements? Okay, well, if not, we'll move on to our presentation this week. We have Josh Rosenau and Mark McCaffrey, who are from the National Center for Science Education. Josh's background is that he did research for a while on evolutionary relationships between Philippine rodent species and then became involved in working towards battling the campaign against teaching evolution in classrooms, and has been at NCSE since 2007. And Mark McCaffrey, most of you know, was a founding member of our Climate Literacy Network and a key member of the CLEAN team before he moved on to NCSE, and he's also a program and policy director, and he's leading up the effort around battling the campaign against teaching climate change in the classroom. And so the slides, everybody should have downloaded by now, and they're going to be talking about NCSE's new climate change education initiative. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Mark and Josh.
Great. Thank you, Tamara. So I assume that everybody has the ability to take a look at the slides, and we'll just kind of talk you through them.
Just say the next slide and maybe give the number so people come in
right.
Late.
So we're at slide number one. And for those of you who have not yet had a chance to look at the NCSE website, just very briefly, NCSE has been around for over 20 years here in the Bay Area, East Bay Area, and primarily focused on defending the teaching of evolution in public schools. Next slide. And I'm going to Josh and I are going to tag team the slides over the next half hour or so. Hopefully, we'll have some time at the end. And Josh will need to take off a little before the top of the hour to get ready for this radio program, To the Point. So, Josh, over to you.
Yeah. So, that's going to be on an NPR station. So you may be able to hear it talking about this bill in Tennessee that we've been tracking. That we're going to know finally today what the governor is going to do about it. And so NCSE started out, as Mark said, you know, really focused on evolution and on the nature of science, because a lot of the issues in the classroom that come up around evolution are really issues about the, you know, what science is and how science works and people's misconceptions of those things. So you know, other stuff comes across our desk and has come across for a long time, evolution being the main conflict, but over the last few years, we really were seeing a lot more about climate change and a lot more similar sorts of attacks on climate change education that we were used to with evolution. And we started asking around, you know, what are people, started looking at how climate change was being dealt with and what those issues were. We're a membership group. We, as the slide says, we tend to work behind the scenes as a clearinghouse. You know, partly we've got a post office box in Berkeley, California. So you can imagine how people in the places where these sorts of issues crop up might react to, "Hi, I'm from Berkeley. I'm here to tell you how to run your school." doesn't tend to go over. So it works better for us to work through our members, through organizations that have their own members on the ground in a school district where something is coming up, or in a state like Tennessee where there's a piece of legislation that we're fighting. And most of what we do really is school district by school district, classroom by classroom, stopping bad stuff. And so on the next slide, you see what we came up with as we were thinking about how evolution and climate change, the educational issues were connected. These sorts of ecosystems that on one hand you know, there are blogs like Panda's Thumb on the evolution side that bring together a lot of the analysis of creationist claims, in the same way that Real Climate does on the climate change side. You've got groups like Talk Origins that have the index of creationist claims that just go through, like, here's the standard creationist claim. And Skeptical Science does a great job of a similar sort of rebuttal to specific claims. In terms of sort of legal and lobbying muscle, there were civil liberties groups like Americans United for Separation of Church and State or the ACLU, that environmental groups provide a lot of that same muscle on the climate side of things. And there are a lot of great groups in both areas doing, you know, including Clean and lots of, I mean, too many to list on the climate change side, really. But in terms of stopping bad stuff from getting into classrooms or critiquing it and having resources for teachers and students to recognize bad material that's coming into classrooms, there didn't seem to be anybody doing that. And so after a lot of internal discussion and talking to educators and other folks to see what was out there, we decided that this was really something that we could contribute to and could help with. And so over the last year, we put out a job search and are very pleased that Mark came in to help us out with all of this.
And I'm happy to be here. It's been quite an interesting challenge and, needless to say, a big major life change moving from Boulder to Berkeley. But next slide. As we know, teaching climate change is very challenging for a lot of different reasons. Some of you were involved with the NRC workshop report that came out last year. You know, the science itself is very complicated. There's just a lot of misconceptions that not only students have, but sometimes teachers have. It crosses many disciplines and should ideally be taught throughout the curriculum, but unfortunately, all too often it falls through disciplinary and curricular cracks, as it were. Also, it hasn't been well coordinated over the years. It's not been well represented in standards. It was missing altogether from the national science standards in the mid-90s, at least in terms of the human impact on climate. And as we know all too well, it's been very politically polarized, which, as we'll talk about in a second here, has its impact in the classroom. Next slide. Some of the related issues. Could somebody put their phone on mute there, please? Thanks. There's a whole psychological and emotional challenge to dealing with climate change, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Unfortunately, climate change is often taught in a very kind of drive-by fashion. So in an environmental studies class, for instance, it might be one day out of the whole semester or maybe a week out of the whole semester. In many cases, as we're seeing from some of the surveys, like the NESTA survey, the NSTA survey, some of the evaluation work that Clean and others have done, all too often well-meaning teachers teach both sides of the so-called controversy, which unfortunately lead students to feeling very confused at the end of the day. Next slide. Back to you, Josh.
So one of the things, a framework that we've found really helpful on the evolution side of things and that really naturally extended to the climate change side of things in talking about attacks on the science is this idea of these three pillars that you see. And so the idea of science denial supported by these three rhetorical pillars that are just consistent through, you go back to the Scopes trial in the 1920s, and people were using these same sorts of arguments there that they are today in Tennessee, again, for this bill that's in the legislature now. It's the same thing that comes up in school board meetings or in classrooms where teachers want to attack evolution or climate change. And we found it useful as a way to sort of organize our thinking about science denial in general, and to think about how we respond to it. The idea of that you attack the science, that you claim that the result of the science is somehow morally pernicious, whether it's with evolution, it's the idea that it's anti-religion, that climate change is anti-capitalist, that it leads to, some sort of socialist dystopia, and the idea that fair, just in, as a matter of fairness, both sides deserve to be heard. We need equal time for both sides. So with creationism, on the next slide, you see the pillars of creationism here, that evolution is a theory in crisis, and people have collected quotations from books going back to the early 1800s where people were saying, oh yeah, this evolution thing is on its way out. Before Darwin, people were saying that and have said it consistently that, oh yeah, any day now people are going to recognize the fallacy of this bad science. The idea of incompatibility of evolution and religion, that, it's you have to believe in the Bible or you have to believe in evolution, and if you accept evolution, then you reject Bible and you reject the idea of the soul and you reject morality, and everyone becomes, as at one school board meeting that I was at in Kansas, a parent worried that if we taught evolution we would be producing little Kansas Nazis. And then the idea of fairness, that teach the debate, teach the controversy, give both sides and let students make up their own minds, as if that's how we handled any other issue in the classroom. Let students decide whether they think this idea of infinite limits really makes sense, and decide whether they want to learn calculus on that basis. And this translates pretty readily on the next slide to the idea to what happened, how people talk about climate change. They say, oh, it's weak science. Look, it's snowing in the winter. Climate change must be wrong. The idea that climate change is itself anti-capitalist, that it's just a plot by socialists to undermine the free market economy, all of this is really a large motivator of a lot of the conversation. The talk about science in both cases is often cover for really talking about, for concerns about these broader moral and social issues. And then, again, the idea that it's unfair to impose climate change solutions, that it's, I should be able to choose whatever light bulbs I want. Don't force me to drive a Prius. I want to drive my gas guzzler. It's unfair to make me buy a more efficient light bulb or a more efficient car until everyone agrees that climate change is real.
And one other piece of that is sometimes they'll say, stop scaring our kids. They feel guilty when we drive them to soccer practice in our SUV. Because the teachers have been telling them that they're killing kids in Africa or things like that. And,
right.
And therefore, we need to have a more balanced approach to talking about climate change.
Or I pay my taxes and I should be allowed to decide what my kids are going to learn in their schools. It can take all of those different fairness sorts of arguments in different forms. So here's a few examples of how this plays out. We don't have to go into too much detail. Here's from on the next slide from the American Coal Foundation, the lesson plans that they put out. Power from Coal argues, the text came out funny here in the conversion, I think, but saying that some scientists believe that adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere from burning coal will make the Earth's climate become warmer. Other scientists do not believe this is likely, or have said the climate is made up of many complex factors we do not fully understand. More time is needed for researchers to gather information on these questions. Well, I don't think that any of us would regard that as the current state of the consensus, right? But they're saying, oh, the science is weak, so therefore, with the implication that therefore we shouldn't, do anything that would hurt the wonderful things that coal does for us and for our economy. In some of you may have seen this video, Unstoppable Solar Cycles, from a group called isit.org.
Next slide.
Oh, sorry, next slide. I'm doing this on my screen and forgetting that I have to tell you to advance also. So this is something that has been mailed out to school districts by the Heartland Institute and other groups for use in classrooms. And it argues, again, that, if a warmer... that it's arguing for this idea with Willie Soon talking about how the solar cycles are all that's causing climate change. It's just a natural cycle. It's not anything that humans can do anything about. That we have the causation all wrong. So if a warmer Earth leads to increased levels of carbon dioxide and not the other way around, then can human use of fossil fuel be the cause of global warming? A student asks. And Dr. Soon says, most of us still have that nagging question in us. Yes, we've emitted all this carbon dioxide, but are we really, really melting all the ice caps, or is it something even more powerful than that? So again, trying to deflect conversation about policy questions by talking about by sort of misrepresenting the state of the science. This slide also got a little bit screwy, but you can see there teacher reviews. A teacher in Mingo Junction, Ohio, says, "This video provided an excellent opposing view for an inconvenient truth. I used it to set up a debate with my honors class." And this is something that we see a lot of. Again, it's the presenting both sides, that same third pillar argument. And we've heard from a lot of teachers that are using this video that way or other denialist material. And then on the next slide, you also see some discussion from sort of the isit.org's background and their connection to through groups like the Milton Friedman Foundation and trying to promote ideas that promote Friedrich Hayek's concept of civil evolution and these sorts of free market fundamentalist ideas that that Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway talk about in their book Merchants of Doubt. And then on the next slide, Mark.
Yeah, so as you, I think you all know, there's a lot of materials out there that teachers are using sometimes because they think it's going to help foster critical thinking in their students, the great global warming swindle is sometimes used in a classroom to balance an inconvenient truth, for instance. And I know that Andy Anderson has kind of done some studies with pre-service teachers at Michigan State, finding that teachers themselves get confused when they see that sort of so-called fair and balanced approach. And just to be clear, we absolutely think that critical thinking is integral to all education, and that's one of our big concerns about the bill in Tennessee, which, as Josh can talk more about in a minute, is sort of an evolution of previous bills that are designed to continue to muddy the waters and ultimately perpetuate confusion here. But we've worked a little bit with the Alliance for Climate Education and surveyed some of their teachers, and the teachers that help host these ACE assemblies, and quite a few of these teachers admit that they're either pressured or of their own accord teach both sides of the so-called both sides of climate change, which is very unfortunate. Next slide is from the globalwarming.org group that is consortium of libertarian think tank folks, the Cato Institute, Competitive Enterprise Institute, Heartland Institute, etc. And they have a website that doesn't seem to be getting much traffic, but they have started to evolve a little bit because some libertarian folks like Patrick Michaels, former state climatologist for Virginia, are having realize it's hard to say with a straight face that climate change isn't happening. So they continue to perpetuate this myth that it's uncertain, that scientists aren't really sure. And one thing that I've seen just in the past year or so is when they're really pushed, they admit that on the other hand, we also may regret not doing anything if man-made global warming does turn out to be a problem. But they inevitably emphasize that it's going to cost a lot. It may hurt poverty efforts around the world, and this is the type of confusion that teachers pick up on, you know, when they hear politicians on the campaign trail saying that climate change is a hoax or that we don't know what's happening. They often feel pressured, you know, maybe not overtly, but just by the political climate to teach both sides so they don't get accused of being alarmist themselves. The next slide, Resisting the Green Dragon, is actually from the religious right and where there's overlap with some of the, you know, kind of free market conservative folks. And Resisting the Green Dragon is a DVD series and book that talks about how environmentalism and climate change are really a new religion that are out to target our youth. It's all part of a plot by the Satan to take over the world through the United Nations, and so there are some conservative religious folks that are anti-global warming, but I think it's important to acknowledge that even a lot of evangelicals take climate change very seriously, and so we have to be careful about kind of painting everybody with the same brush here. There are some nuances to how this all plays out, and there may be people who are actually on board with climate change who we might not expect to be at first glance. Next slide. Just to sort of segue into a little discussion about these academic freedom bills, such as the one in Tennessee, again, they promote critical thinking. They often explicitly single out evolution and climate change, along with like chemical origins of life and things like that, which obviously tie in with evolution. But overall, they undermine the nature of science by claiming that there is debate and controversy where there really isn't any. And so these academic freedom bills essentially provide cover for teachers in particular to teach the controversy. Josh, next slide.
Yeah, so on the next slide we have, given our background with evolutionary biology here, we tend to think about things in trees. So this is an evolutionary tree sort of these academic freedom bills, and we've tracked dozens of these over the last since 2004, when the first of these was introduced in Alabama, and these talk about this language about presenting a full range of views, protecting the rights of students and teachers to present these views and not to be punished for holding ideas about alternative theories, especially around evolution. It doesn't name any of those alternative theories by name, but I think we have a pretty good idea of what those would have been. And a later version of that was amended to say that it shall not be construed to promote religion. There's some builds in here that I'm not indicating, but that have some of this language. And that language is sort of like, I've been trying to think of a better analogy for this, but if you have a friend come to you and say, I'm not racist, but, oh, you know, black people or yada yada, it sort of means that they are racist. And this shall not be construed language feels sort of the same way to me. Like, if the bill really weren't about religion, they probably wouldn't have to say so. And from that that version in 2005, was actually turned into model legislation by the Discovery Institute, which is an anti-evolution group in Seattle. And they've shopped it around to a bunch of other states over the years. And there's been a separate lineage of these that started out with language from Texas science standards, from local policies in various local school districts across the country, that came together in a parish policy in Ouachita Parish, Louisiana, that again talks about now critical analysis, talks about the strengths and weaknesses of evolution, and it again talks, it's the first one to make a linkage of talking about evolution, global warming, human cloning, all of these other topics. And as with all these policies, it's not requiring anybody to do anything. It's permissive. It allows teachers who want to get into these supposed alternatives under the guise of critical analysis or critical thinking to do so. And out of that you get a merging of these two and another lineage of these bills that includes one that actually passed in Louisiana and the bill that's in Tennessee right now. We've tracked over 40 of these bills since 2004 in 13 states. The one in Tennessee that we're watching right now passed both houses and is sitting before the Senate. And this is he had 10 days to either sign it or veto it or becomes law. And this is the 10th day. So we're very interested to see what happens today on that. And these are, again, you know, the language is quite subtle, but it's picking up old creationist fights that, you know, they've often claimed that that teachers have an academic freedom right to introduce creationism into classrooms. And this is, and the courts have consistently said that they don't. So this is really an attempt to settle scores on that front. But the concern is really that it could well open up a whole bunch of other doors, including on climate change, where there's not even a First Amendment issue to fall back on. So here you can see the language of the Tennessee bill in the next slide. This is the Senate version, the House version that's in front of the governor was slightly amended from this language, but not in any ways that really matter for our purposes. There you see it in the second paragraph talking about how some subjects, including evolution, chemical origins of life, global warming, and human cloning, can cause controversy. They amended that to say that it can cause debate and disputation, as if that were somehow dramatically different. And then you have this paragraph that says that, oh, all these administrators from the State Board of Education down to the local principal shall endeavor to create an environment that encourages students to explore scientific questions, learn about scientific evidence, develop critical thinking skills, and respond appropriately and respectfully to differences of opinion about controversial issues, as if teachers weren't already doing that. You know, this is something that, and later on it prohibits the administrators from doing anything to undercut those efforts, however that would be. So it's at this point just not entirely clear how it would play out in practice in the classroom. You know, what are the limits that it places on teachers? And in the next slide, you can see a comparison of language to the bill that passed in Louisiana, and you just see a lot of almost identical phrases popping up in both of them, including singling out evolution and climate change. And in both of these cases, the bills only talk about science education. It's not talking about how English teachers or history teachers should handle it. It's not like you could, like a teacher who decided that they wanted to talk about how Shakespeare was actually the Earl of Oxford could bring that up in an English class, but a teacher who wants to say that evolution isn't happening or that global warming is a hoax would be protected.
So I think a lot of you are familiar with on the next slide, the quote from Luntz back in 2002, where he talks about how to win the global warming debate by basically using the approach that the tobacco industry used for many years, which was to just focus on the uncertainty and say that scientists really don't know for sure. Obviously, this has worked very well over the past decade, if not much longer, in fact. Some folks trace these efforts to derail and delay any adult conversation about climate change back 25 years ago, back during the George H.W. Bush era, when the first Rio conference and the IPCC first got set up. So this tactic of just continuing to focus on the uncertainty and how there are alternative theories that need to be debated has perpetuated this confusion. And on the next slide, I think it's worth noting that this is really an issue that the sociology community has some very interesting insights on. And if you all get a chance to look at our website, we have a whole section on denial that I think is worth looking at. Stanley Cohen, in a book called States of Denial back in 2001, talks about how there's really three key types of denial. And he doesn't explicitly focus on climate change, but I think it's very apropos. There's kind of the literal denial that it's not happening at all, and we hear still that occasionally comes up in the blog comments, or somebody saying that climate change is a hoax. But more and more we hear the kind of interpretive view of denial, that it's happening, but it's, you know, maybe it's cosmic rays or, you know, CO2 is actually good for the environment, that type of thing. But the third type of denial is denying the implications and responsibility, which I think is where some of the research, whether it's Six Americas or John Krosnick, comes in, that Kari Norgaard, who is at University of Oregon these days, did a book called Living in Denial, where she focused on a community in Norway and observed that even though they don't have a disinformation campaign or machine in Norway, Norwegian people are still essentially in denial about dealing with climate change. And so she has observed that there's kind of a social numbing and certain sort of motivated avoidance is, I guess, one of the sociological terms to describe how people accept climate change. It's common knowledge, but it's also unimaginable. And, you know, if it does come up, because oftentimes it's just not discussed at all, but when it does come up, it comes up in terms of who to blame for it other than ourselves. And so I think that's one of the enormous challenges that we face as a nation, if not the world, in dealing with this. Josh, next slide.
And so on the next slide, you see we were talking a little bit about this before, the idea that you know, political conservatives and religious conservatives are different in a lot of ways, and the overlap between them is what we think of as the religious right, and that the global warming denial draws mostly on that politically conservative side of things, and also from that overlapping area, from the religious conservative part of it. But there are political conservatives who are not global warming deniers. There are religious conservatives, a lot of evangelicals, who are very concerned about creation care. And in survey work that I've seen, there where you ask people about their views on evolution and their views on climate change, there's certainly a correlation between rejecting one of the sciences and rejecting the other, but it's not a huge correlation. There are a lot of people who, precisely because they are creationists, they look at Genesis and it says that you know, humans have dominion over the earth, and they think that imposes a burden of stewardship. And so precisely because they're creationists, they're concerned about climate change. You know, it's not the landscape here is different in its own special ways that can be tricky to navigate when we if we just try to assume that politics is politics. It gets tricky and messy in ways that can be interesting and beneficial to us as well as dangerous for us.
So I think, why don't we kind of zip through the next couple slides. The slide on energy literacy, I think you're all familiar with that. A wonderful resource that just came out that hopefully can help us as a country through education, whether it's informal or in the classroom, have a more informed discussion about energy in our lives. And of course, many of you were involved with climate literacy, if either developing the essential principles or perhaps involved with a project that made use of these essential principles. The next slide there is just kind of a cartoon about making our students competitive in science without teaching them science. But there is some good news, and I'm kind of rushing through this a little bit, hoping that we have a little bit of time before the top of the hour when Josh needs to take off here for questions. But the next generation science standards are coming. They'll be released for public discussion later this month, and you know, ACHIEVE had some survey folks do a look at voters and what their attitudes towards national science standards are and the importance of science education, and lo and behold, they found that overall the people that they surveyed find that that science education in general is extremely important. There's a slide there showing how important you think improving the quality of science education is in our public schools. And then, what grade would you give science education in public schools? Most people would give the nation schools a C, or and local schools as well. then finally there's a slide showing that there is broad support for these new science education standards, that 54% strongly favor, 87% overall favor the new science standards. And then just very quickly, we have, just to give you a sense of some of the things that we do here at NCSC relative to climate change, we have been approached by a number of people, including a parent upstate New York who was willing to talk to the press about her experience, but her ninth grade science teacher, this is the slide titled Clifton Park, her ninth grade science teacher was doubt-mongering about the scientific consensus on climate change, and she was able to resolve the situation by essentially confronting the teacher with another teacher present, and then we don't quite know exactly what happened, but all of a sudden the teacher agreed that he wouldn't teach that way again, and it may have been the principal at the school, it may have been some other authority that basically said that you need to teach the district curriculum, and casting doubt on climate change is not part of the district curriculum. So I think that's just one example of the type of things that we do. And then, Josh, maybe you can briefly talk about what we can and can't do.
Yeah, so the next slide just talks about sort of, I'm not going to read the whole thing, I'm just putting that there, sort of, what we tend to do is work behind the scenes, work in coalition with other groups like the Climate Literacy Network, environmental groups, science education groups. In Tennessee, we were able to get letters of support from a lot from NESTA and from NAGT, and have them contact their members in the state to ask them to talk to the legislature and the governor. You know, it means more coming from them than it would coming from us out in California. We're from out of state. We're not part of their community. And so a lot of it is building those networks, training local activists. We worked with someone who's going to be on the radio show to put together a petition, and they delivered 3,000 signatures to the governor last week. You know, building those networks and having them ready, helping lobby for good standards, including the next generation standards as they come out, fighting bad bills and working for good ones. Because we're a nonprofit, we can't get involved in elections, so we can't tell people to vote against some crazy creationist or climate change denier, but we can certainly get involved when that person starts trying to do something bad as a public official. And you know, being a clearinghouse for good resources that are out there, helping, pointing people. On our website, we have a lot of links to the climate literacy, the clean website, and the resources that are there. You know, our goal is not to rebuild the washing machine, to reinvent the wheel, but really to connect people with stuff that's already out there. And then on the next slide, we have you can see the new climate change section of the website. And then the build here may be a little bit funny, but just there are four sections of it. We have a brief introduction to the science of climate change. You know, is the climate changing? Why is it happening? Is it because of humans? What will be the effects, and what can we do about it? The site talks about you know, guidance for teachers, linking out to resources, but also giving a lot of that drafted by Mark about, you know, the sort of philosophy of how to handle climate change and conflicts about climate change in the classroom. And I encourage you to look through it. There's a lot of really great stuff on all through there, and we'd love your feedback if you have concerns about the way that anything's done or other things that we ought to be adding. There's a section about climate change denial, talking about the pillars that we discussed before, but also some of the ways that it plays out in classrooms and why we use that phrase, that term rather than others. And then resources for people who are taking action, guidance on writing letters, talking about why there is this conflict at all, and a list of what we call Voices for Climate Change, which is parallel to our Voices for Evolution project, which is a book just collecting statements from scientific societies and educational societies and other leaders in the community saying, here's why it's important to teach climate change, which can be really helpful for someone in a conflict to be able to say, look, it's not just me. hear all of these people who you respect who say that this is important also. And so that can be really valuable. And I hope that you guys find it useful as well.
And we are a membership organization, so if you like what we're doing, please consider becoming a member.
And the next slide has our has the website, our Facebook page, our Twitter account. We're on YouTube. We're all over the place.
Yeah. So we've got a couple minutes left before the top of the hour, and Josh, I know you might have to take off, but any questions? I'm happy to stay after the top of the hour if anybody's interested.
Yeah, and I'll just,
Josh and Mark, in case Josh has to leave before we do end. So are there any questions?
We said everything. We were so perfect.
So do people tend to find you more, or are you, I mean, when you talk about working in a particular school or the particular issue, do they seek you out, or are you finding them? How does that work?
It's a little of both. We've had some very good press about the launch of our initiative in January, and there was an initial article in the LA Times, and since then there's been quite a few articles here and there, and then people... if they need help, contact us directly. In other instances, we do kind of seek out people that could use help or clearly do need help. So it's a little of both.
How big are you? Do you have people, besides the two of you, how many people are there?
It's something like I don't remember exactly where we stand now, but it's something like a dozen so people on staff.
But over 4,000 members around the country.
Yeah. And the staff is all out here in California, but they're Citizens for Science groups that we work with a lot in many states.
And like on Tennessee initiative, we teamed up with a group here in California called Climate Parents, and also another group based here in Berkeley that does a lot of kind of networking using social media, and so I think we actually were up to 6,000 names on that petition through signon.org, and that's up from over 3,000 names last Thursday when the names were delivered to the governor.
Mark, this is Scott Carley. I'm curious about your relationship with the National Science Teachers Association. Do you work closely with them, or is it really more on a grassroots level and not directly through a national organization?
Josh, I think you probably have a better sense of the history there.
Yeah, no, we've got a really good relationship with NSTA and with all, you know, and with NABT and NESTA and NAGT. You know, they've all they're often helpful in connecting us with local teachers. They've given us statements when we needed them, or put us in touch with their members in a state. Their goal is, you know, they're trying to help teachers do good things, and we're trying to stop bad things from happening. So
okay, so that's how you see sort of the roles, the difference in the roles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we can do a very good sort of good cop bad cop thing also with a lot of groups. Sometimes we're the bad cop, and sometimes, you know, we can always say, well, you know, you can talk to us about this, or you can talk to the ACLU about it.
Yeah.
And then they can be our bad cop. So it works out.
Good.
And are you working with the EPA at all?
Not directly.
Not really.
We do have, obviously, connections to people that work within the federal government. You know, for instance, with the DOE, we talked with some of the people involved with the energy literacy, but they have to maintain distance from groups such as ours that are more kind of in the trenches,
yeah,
so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, Mark and Josh, you know, I don't. Doesn't sound like you're invited, but this Monday, April 16th, is the White House Summit, the one I have been on women and environment. This one's on environmental education.
Oh, yeah?
And the proximity it gives you to the conversation, it would be so good to get one of you at the table.
Well, I'm going to be in Washington next week, but when's this meeting?
It's by invitation, but I'm gonna send an email. I'm gonna send them. It's on Monday the 16th, and it's 8:30 till noon, and then there's a reception. But it's mine was small, about 80 people, and breakout sessions. But I'm gonna see if I can get you an invitation, and if I do, spend the money and get there.
I'll be attending the tri-agency meeting that I think a few of you will be attending in Alexandria, starting on Tuesday evening.
The summit that you're talking about, Carolyn, is I think on Monday. And is it just one day or two?
It's one day, the 16th.
Yeah, I think it overlaps.
Are you going?
I'm not, but the director of education here for NOAA is going.
Good.
But
no, some of my friends are going too. But I wanted to see but I think Mark and Josh and what your outfit's doing is so integral to the big cause. You know, it's. Frank, if you have any pull, you go ahead now.
So one of the interesting things that's going on now is this focus on environmental education as different from in STEM, and it's a really interesting space to explore the difference between those two. I mean, we have a foot in both of those camps, but it's nice to see the environmental education coming on stronger than has been the case.
Mark and Josh, this is Kristen from the Climate Reality Project. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the Heartland Institute and that recent controversy, and what, if anything, your organization did to respond to that.
Well, you know, they've been at this for many years. In fact, I can send you kind of a history of their efforts to come up with alternative curriculum or, you know, cause confusion in the public discourse.
Mm-hmm.
But this most recent thing that came to light back in January, where some of their internal documents were made public. Actually, a lot of they had advertised a lot of this through their monthly newsletter as well. So they were pretending to be shocked that their inner secrets were being revealed. But I think certainly the Climate Reality Project did a great job of really calling them out on the ridiculousness of kind of teaching that type of controversy and debate when there really isn't one in the scientific community. For those of you who haven't seen the video, maybe you can send that out to the list, because it's a short video, but it really makes a strong point about how dangerous it is to be opening the door to these so-called alternative views of strong science.
And one of the things I thought was interesting about it is, there's a trend that I've seen within the creationist world of creating these elaborate pseudoscientific infrastructures, that they have their own journals and they have their own conferences where, in order to be an editor or in order to submit a paper to one of these creationist journals, you have to sign off on their statement of faith that the Earth is 6,000 years and everything. But so the way that they, but it creates this insular community where if you only are looking at other people who publish and attend those same conferences, it's really easy to believe that you actually are winning.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of the Heartland curriculum and the conferences that they do and the publications that they put out are really aimed at creating that same insular world where if you only pay attention to other people within those circles, you can really believe that climate change is on the ropes.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, how widespread that manages to be, and how when the curriculum that they're talking about producing is actually available, how many people actually try to pick up on it and what they try to do with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the bigger concern for us, and we have to be absolutely vigilant against these type of issues, but the bigger issue is that teachers don't have a good background. Many of them are already teaching both sides because they don't know any better. And, hopefully the next generation science standards will be widely adopted and teachers will get the training and tools that they need to teach 21st century science.
Yeah, I was amazed when we had there was a survey that the Alliance for Climate Education did of the teachers that they have worked with in the past. So these are motivated teachers who are already concerned about climate change, they're working with ACE, that when they surveyed them and asked them how they taught climate change, a remarkable number of them said that they present both sides and that they look for resources that they can do to make sure that the students hear both sides and can make up their own mind, as if there were two legitimate scientific sides to the question of whether the planet is getting warmer and who is responsible. It's just, I mean, so within the world of teachers at large, it has to be just epidemic.
Well, you know, speaking as a science teacher, there is this fear that you say the wrong thing or give the wrong statistic. And I hate to be, well, I'm trying to be the optimist, but realistically, the cutting off, the whole campaign against the teaching profession now is cutting off the top in an attempt to raise the bottom. So in addition to what you're saying, I don't think the capacity of our future science teachers is any more robust than our current ones. And that's another fight I'm trying to take on, the teaching profession thing, because that's why I think the work you're doing is so important to sort of give these people a backbone and to say we're in the fight with you.
Yeah. Well, we also think that really engaging parents is a potentially very strong strategy to push for, you know, strong national standards, voluntary national curriculum, perhaps, and ideally to push for climate and related global change, environmental issues to be taught across the curriculum.
Yeah, and you know, I just got to keep pushing the agenda of the informal science.
Mm-hmm.
Institutions for you, Mark and Doug, because I, you know, people get their science outside of the classroom more than inside.
Sure.
And so the more we can message some of this in tandem with formal and informal, you know, bridge it, that's very fertile ground, you know, that intersection between formal and informal.
Yep, no question. Well, listen, thank you all very much for taking time out of your busy day to listen to us, you know, share some of the background on our climate change education initiative. I think you can certainly get in touch with me. I often post something on the Climate Literacy Network listserv, and in fact, I just sent out a note about the show that Josh will be on later today, To the Point, and a link to the petition in Tennessee that now has over 6,000 signatures. But let me know if you have any questions, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mark, and Josh, if you're still there.
Yep, thank you all for having
us. Thank you.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Anybody left? All right.